Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that features the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, together with Kay Puddock. Hi, Kay.
Hello, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
Well, this is, for many, the first work day of the new year, the day when the rubber meets the road for all of those New Year's resolutions.
Yeah, it's certainly that time of the year.
It's, I think, also going to be a day when things get a bit scrambled. We have a storm on the way here in central Iowa. We've heard of, I read of 7 inches of snow today possible. Today's Local Talk covers a couple of, or it relates to a couple of, you might call them, New Year's resolutions on behalf of the community that we serve. Later in the hour, we are going to be covering the efforts of the City of Ames to improve HRTA transportation services, which will be the topic of a special open meeting tonight. HRTA is the bus that comes around to people who make specific appointments with them, and HRTA stands for Heart of Iowa Regional Transportation Authority. So later in the show, we're going to hear from Matthew Goodman, Ames City Councilman, to talk about the situation with HRTA. And Kay Puddock, who is here with us this morning, has a community service appreciation to announce.
Yes, and even that's an appropriate improvement story, appropriate for the new year, you might say.
The Skunk River Watershed Management Authority recently released its plan for improving water quality. And in a sense, we've got to thank the community service organization that I'll be talking about, which is the Skunk River Watershed Coalition, which is a purely voluntary organization. The improvement plan that the authority has issued grew out of the organization KHOI is featuring this month, the Squirrel Creek Watershed Coalition.
And Kay, you know, when I was covering water issues this summer, I heard about these kind of authorities being set up by the state in very select areas here and there along in certain very well-defined watersheds. And basically, these were the only areas getting funding to improve water quality. Lots of stretches of rivers and streams and lakes in our state have compromised water quality, but to attract this designation and the funding that goes with it, there has to be detailed data on the water quality.
And for that, we have to thank the volunteers of the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition, which I'm highlighting this month, January. We sat down with Irv Klaus, its co-founder, the other day, and talked about the organization's achievements. Irv wears many hats, and today he's here to talk about the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition as one of our nonprofit social service organizations that we talk about every month. Welcome, Irv. So glad you could come. Perhaps you could begin by telling us what exactly a watershed is.
A watershed is a geographical feature on the landscape where when water falls on it, it all flows downhill, of course, to a water body of some kind, either a stream, a river, or a lake. And so it's a sort of like a, think of it as a bathtub, and any water that would fall on that bathtub all drains towards the drain.
Right. And, or like a shed roof, a roof. So in other words, it falls on both sides and down into the gutters, and the gutters would be the rivers on each side of the shed roof.
Right. That's another way of thinking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we all live on a watershed.
Exactly.
Everywhere. And the little watersheds feed into the big ones.
Ames lies in two watersheds, actually. One is called the South Skunk Watershed, and the other one is the Squaw Creek Watershed. And these both flow into the Mississippi River.
So they're part of the Mississippi water.
That's right. The Mississippi watershed is the largest, we call a basin, really. It's one that all the water that falls in that basin eventually flows into the Mississippi and then eventually into the Gulf of Mexico.
I understand the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition is a completely voluntary organization. Why don't you explain to us the work you do? And
well, we started in 2001. In fact, in March 22nd, 2001, we had a an all-day conference at the Sheman Building at Iowa State. We invited a large number of people to come to just talk about what they knew about the watershed and what they saw as the problems. The outcome of that was that a group of people met at the end of the day and said, we think we should form a resident-led, that is, people that live in the watershed should get together and figure out what they can do. And so that's where the coalition was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And we've tried to involve the residents that live in the watershed, both the rural and the urban areas. From that, we developed this monitoring program, which essentially was that we would voluntarily collect water samples and analyze them for water quality issues such as temperature, oxygen, whether or not there were nitrates and phosphorus and bacteria. About the same time that we started the coalition, the Department of Natural Resources was starting the Iowa Water Program, and they were offering training. I think it cost us $25 to take the training, which was 4-hour to a 6-hour program, and then there were advanced kinds of training for sampling bacteria and also invertebrate organisms, insect larvae and that kind of thing that live in the creek, trying to assess what the health of that creek represented at the present time. And this Iowa Water training, they supported us by giving us field kits that would measure these factors in the field. And then they set up a website where we could enter all that data. And so that data is in a database that's maintained by the Department of Natural Resources under their Iowa Water Program. And that's in the Geological Bureau of DNR. They gave us a lot of support over the years with both training and with this equipment. And every year we could replenish our supplies free. So that's been a very big part of our monitoring program is the DNR support. There is some question as to whether or not this kind of data is credible. And so the DNR was able to get the Environmental Protection Agency to assess these kits that we use and certify that they were, you know, a legitimate way of doing it. And so that's helped as well. We set up a program by which we would monitor, the volunteers would go out and monitor their site, and they would specify that site on the website. They would pick one or two sites and monitor those every month, the same place, and describe the stretch of the stream, habitat that was there, and then monitor for water quality, chemistry, and physical attributes of that stream. And that's been a very successful program because over now 13 years, we've actually accumulated a fairly large database of information. Some of our volunteers thought that, well, sampling this way whenever we go out, you know, was not regulated. We'd let the volunteers decide when they would go out. I know personally that I would try to go out when the weather was nice because I didn't like to sample in the rain and so on. So we decided that there should be two times during the year when we should sample all the sites on the same day to see what the health of that stream was on that day.
Right.
And so we call them snapshots. And on the second Saturday of May and the second Saturday of October, we aggregate all of our volunteers and go out and sample those sites. And we have about 50 sites, I think it's 55 sites, identified in the watershed all the way from near the source of the streams up in the watershed to right here in Ames. I've been sampling two sites in Ames for these many years, one at 4th Street at the 4th Street Bridge and one at the Duff Avenue Bridge. So we've got a really good information. And when we finally, we've been telling people, you know, that we need to draw more attention to the watershed and what's there because we felt that the levels of nutrients and the levels of bacteria were higher than they should be. And we needed to identify the source of those contaminants, and we also needed to know essentially how to clean it up. And so this led then to a formation of what's called a Watershed Management Authority, which is essentially it has no authority, not in the sense of being regulatory. It's not a regulatory authority. It's simply an authority that's given under the Iowa State Code to cities and counties to do something in that watershed. And
does that mean you receive funds to help?
Yes. In fact, we received funds from the Iowa Economic Development Agency first to organize. This was essentially a small grant to contact all the participants, and that is the county supervisors, the soil and water districts, and the cities and towns that are in the watershed. So we formed this authority and then obtained additional money to hire an engineering consultant to develop a 20-year plan that we could use to advise soil and water districts, advise counties, advise the farmers and the residents in the cities as well as to what they could do to reduce these contaminants. And we are in a process of applying for additional money under the nutrient reduction strategy that the state has set up in order to implement some of these practices.
So this microdata that you could call it, that your coalition had gathered on a volunteer basis, has led to a much more integrated, well-funded, and sort of state-supervised level effort to clean up the rivers.
Right, and that I feel very good about the fact that that's happened. Not only that, because of we've attracted this money and attracted this work that's been going on, Iowa State University researchers are now getting interested in Squaw Creek watershed as a place where they can do further research, and I think that that's another positive thing that's happened out of this. Now, you might ask, is the coalition no longer needed? Well, it turns out that it's expensive to monitor, and the consultants that we had said, we hope that the coalition will continue to monitor because we need that data to continue to see if we're doing any good.
Right. So with this these is practices. A very expensive service that you're providing for.
Exactly.
Yes.
Hopefully the Iowa Water Program with the DNR will continue, and they've been under a lot of budgetary constraints recently and has reduced some of their support that they've given us. And particularly with the sampling and analysis of bacterial. In our snapshots, since we started those about 5 or 6 years ago, we have collected the water and submitted the water to the state hygienic lab to analyze for the bacteria. A laboratory analysis is certainly better than the crude kind of analysis that we do ourselves. I really feel that it's pretty good. But the laboratory gives us a lot more credibility. And just in this last year, they have cut off that service. We no longer can have our samples analyzed by the hygienic lab because of budgetary constraints, supposedly. So I've been monitoring bacteria for over 10 years. And let me give you some things that happen with that. What I do is collect the water sample with the procedures that we're trained with under the Iowa Water Program, and we do it 3 replications at each site. And I take it back to my home and pour that media into a sterile Petri dish, and then I put it in a styrofoam box with a light bulb inside. Oh. It's sort of like a home incubator.
Right.
And leave it for 48 hours. And during that 48 hours, the bacteria will grow on the surface of that Petri dish. And then I can make a count. And because it's the media that's used identifies E. coli, which is a very strong indicator of bacterial contamination, I can count the colonies of E. coli that are on that plate. And then, you know, that becomes our database. Over that period, there have been 2 instances in which I was able to discover a very bad contamination. For example, in 2009, in September of that year, I was sampling at the Duff Avenue Bridge and discovered that there was something in the water because the petri dishes were really clogged with, well, it turned out to be that it was Escherichia coli, E. coli, and this E. coli was up to estimated by the lab that makes the media because we were concerned that the media was bad. They looked at it and they said, well, you've got up to 9 million colonies of E. coli.
Could I just interject here? Mm-hmm. If you've got that much E. coli, which of course is can cause very dangerous illness in humans, if you've got that much in the water and someone like wades in the water, could they get it from that, get the disease?
Certain strains of E. coli are dangerous. Most of the time, E. coli does not hurt because we have it in our guts. In fact, it occurs in all warm-blooded animals, mm-hmm. including, you know, raccoons and deer, but only warm-blooded animals. And anyway, but it's an indicator that there could be other things in the water, such as Salmonella, for example, or some other Cryptosporidia, which is another very dangerous bacteria. And so it's an indicator. And in this case, this high level of E. coli in September of 2009 turned out to be that there was a break in the sanitary sewer system in Ames that was lying very close to a storm sewer, and it was leaking into that storm sewer and going directly into Squaw Creek. So notified the city of this, and they did a search, and they found the break, and it was actually all the way up by Lincoln Way on Kellogg Avenue. And they had to dig up the street and repair that in order to stop that contamination. But here's a case where the monitoring identified this problem, and it was able to be corrected very quickly. Well, then in 2010, we had another instance, the same site of a high level of contamination in September, and it was the month after the big flood that we had, the 2010 flood. It turns out that flood washed out a whole section of our sanitary sewer that crosses under Squaw Creek, just upstream from the Duff Avenue Bridge. And that was, again, we identified that there was a break and they were able to correct it. So that's what monitoring will do.
And you do that every month?
Yes.
We're talking with Irv Klaus of Ames, who is one of the co-founders of the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition. Now, that brings up something else in my mind when you were talking about the sanitary sewer flooding into the storm sewer. Now, we are fortunate, I believe, in Ames that our sanitary sewers and our storm sewers are supposedly, unless there's a break, separate. But that's not always the case, is it?
No. In fact, in some large cities, for example, Chicago and Portland, Oregon, have had, just for convenience sake, when they were established 100 years ago, they put both the sanitary material and the stormwater in the same pipes in order to get rid of it. And, of course, in those days, nobody thought about the fact that this sewage that was going into these pipes was contaminating our lakes and our streams. Well, they found that, of course, as the buildup of populations occurred, that this we could no longer dilute it enough to make a difference. So the Environmental Protection Agency came into being in the 1970s and put in regulations that require these cities to actually treat that water or to separate it, mm-hmm. and treat it. So we have separate systems in Ames, and we treat our sanitary systems before that effluent goes into the streams. The storm sewers carry storm water, that is, rainwater that comes off our streets and our houses and so on. That goes directly into the creeks without treatment.
Why don't you talk about the education that you did with the medallions in the storm sewers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We knew from information provided by other groups around the country that some people thought that you could dump anything down those storm sewer inlets.
Automobile oil down there and
right,
stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
They thought it would go into the sanitary system. I mean, people mostly thought that. And it doesn't. It goes directly into the creeks. And people would dump, for example, they would drain their own motor oil from their cars. And, well, where do I do with it? Put it down the storm sewer. Or they would pick up pet waste and throw it down the sewer. And that all that was, you know, really contaminating our streams. And we needed something on those inlets, that, you know, on the street where those storm sewer inlets are located, to tell people that this goes directly to the creek. So the coalition organized a group of volunteers. A lot of them were high school students. Some of our volunteers were teachers in high school, and they would organize students to help. And then the city said, well, we'll provide the little plastic medallions to go on the, you know, at the site, and you can put these. We started out using stenciling, but that washed off after a while with just ordinary paint. So these plastic medallions now are located all over the city of Ames.
Yes, I'm noticing.
Directing people that anything goes down that sewer goes directly to the stream. I think it has a little fish on it to identify with.
Have you noticed a difference since you've put those medallions there?
Well, it's hard to. We haven't really been sampling for those kinds of waste mm-hmm. materials, so we don't know. But
and over time, have you seen any trend in the nutrient levels and bacteria that you monitor?
No. In fact, we're hoping that now we've got this plan where we have these practices identified to correct this situation, that will occur. It's highly variable information. For example, when you get a rain event, it could be a rain event of an inch or two of water, or it could be 8 inches of water. Either way, you get a lot of material washed into the creek as a result of that rain event. And so nutrient levels might jump, you know, and you'll get a peak, or even bacteria levels. And a lot of places have been sampling bacteria, found that the high levels of bacteria are correlated with those rain events.
And that brings up something else in my mind, which is we hear a lot now about having permeable driveways, for example, and putting in rain gardens and swales to prevent or to minimize the inrush of water after rain because, you know, from parking lots and roofs of houses and buildings.
Yes, and there's been a real technical science developed around this kind of thing for urban areas. And Ames has been doing quite a bit promoting and giving incentives to people to put in rain gardens and permeable driveways. And that is going to help not only the water quality, but also the water quantity, because it will infiltrate that water into the ground. In fact, we have urban conservationists who are state employees who work now in the major metropolitan areas in the state that help cities promote this. And we've had the one here in central Iowa is assisted by Pat Sauer, who has been advising the city on different things. And there's a proposal now that the city has applied for to re-landscape all the area around City Hall as to encourage infiltration of water, including putting permeable surfaces on their parking lot mm-hmm. on the west side of the building. And we think that that will, you know, really help to reduce flash flooding on Squaw Creek.
And when you say it increases the quantity, you're talking about the water that filtrates down to the groundwater, which is where we,
exactly.
in Ames, obtain
that,
our water.
And that groundwater is our drinking water aquifer. So it's very important that we maintain and keep that aquifer in good shape. And we found that the riverbed and the floodplains of the Skunk River and Squaw Creek provide this ecological services that are free to cleanse the water as it passes through that layers of soil into that groundwater aquifer. And one of the reasons why we don't have to treat water as much as they do, say, in Des Moines, which they use water right out of the river, and they have to, they have the largest nitrate removal plant in the world, taking nitrates out to meet the 10 parts per million regulation for nitrates. And it costs the city of Des Moines $7,000 a day to do that when they run that nitrate removal. Whereas we get it free because the riverbed and our floodplains are providing that service. And sampling nitrates in our aquifer, taking water directly out of the wells, shows that there's very little nitrate there. So you can see how those streams are very important to
yes.
that ecological service.
and we can see what a wonderful service your coalition is providing. Before we end, would you like to say something about encourage people? What should they do if they'd like to become a volunteer, and what kinds of work can they do?
In order to become a volunteer, and we really do need more volunteers, because I'm getting to the age where I can't climb down the banks of the stream as well as I used to, and I need somebody to take over my sites. And we've got a lot of other volunteers who have, you know, moved to another city or something, and we have to replace them. So they need training from the Iowa Water Program, and they are still providing that training. And they can go to the Iowa Water website on the DNR and find out when those training sessions are being held. Or they can contact me, and my number at home is 233-3327.
Let's say that again.
515-233-3327. And I can help them with that information and how to get that training. You can also, without the training, accompany one of our volunteers and see how it is first. And we will be having another snapshot coming in May.
Just to remind people, if they haven't been listening the whole time, just remind people what a snapshot is.
Okay, a snapshot is a day when we try to sample all of our sampling sites on the same day. Well, we have a potential number of 55 sampling sites, but sometimes we don't have enough people to do all those. So we try to get at least 30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
They can become a volunteer and then get further training for bacteria and invertebrate sampling and so on.
It sounds it would be very interesting work, very interesting volunteer work.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
And we've also tried to encourage farmers who want to know what their land is contributing to sample themselves, you mm-hmm. know. And
a lot of farmers, I believe, could spend a lot less money on fertilizer and so on and do themselves a favor and do the water quality a favor, too.
Exactly. One of the things I'm hoping that we can do with this new Watershed Management Authority is to improve the health of the soil in our watershed. So this is looking at, you know, really where those nutrients and where the bacteria is coming from and trying to keep it on the land rather than
and in the
out
water,
of our creeks.
Yes.
And I think we have a lot of opportunity to increase soil organic matter, increase the productivity of the soil, and reduce our problems with water quality and quantity.
Well, thank you, Irv. And obviously, although it's called the Watershed Coalition, it obviously embraces a huge area, many areas of concern, as you said, the soil, the water, and everything. Well, thank you so much, Irv. That was Irv Klaus representing the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition, the organization featured in January as part of KHOI's Community Service Appreciation Program.
The coalition's website is squawcreekwatershed.org, and we'll have a link to that on our own website, khoifm.org, by the end of the day. That was Jefferson Airplane with the tune Embryonic Journey. Song you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and the song was a tribute to the transition into the new year that we've had over these last 5 days. Now we're actually here, and it's also a tribute to the Art and Music Collaborative, Rebirth, or Re:Birth, that some young people in Ames are putting on these next 3 weeks, or I should say these next 3 weekends. Actually, I should say this past weekend and the next 2 weekends, because they've already had some events. The events center around Design on Main, the gallery that will be open Saturday and Sunday for the next 2 weekends between 5 and 8, 5 and 7, and also DG's Tap House and the Iowa Music Store. So check out Rebirth. And another announcement is that our jingle jangle siren sound has been going off in the studio a couple times already this morning. That signals a big winter storm on the way. And so think twice before you make plans for this evening. If you have planning to travel at all, you might want to keep an eye on the weather.
Well, Greta, we spoke early in the hour about an improvement plan for water quality. Another entity that has shown the need for improvement is HERTA, that is the Heart of Iowa Regional Transportation, whose problems have hinged on, among other things, a shortage of drivers. Tonight, Monday, January the 5th at 7 p.m., the Ames City Council holds a listening session on its HERTA improvement plan.
Yes, and I don't know what the situation will be if we have 7 inches of snow, but we are pleased to have in the studio Ames City Council member Matthew Goodman to explain the issue to our listeners. Matthew is also on the board of directors of SciRide, so he spends a lot of time thinking about public transportation. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you, Greta.
So, Matthew, can you quickly tell us the context and the purpose of the public meeting tonight?
You bet. I guess first I just want to thanks for having me. These issues are important, but they're complex sometimes, and so it's good to have an opportunity to talk about them a little bit. This really began maybe a year ago to even longer ago with some input from users of HERTA bus services. And as a reminder to everyone, HERTA is not a city organization. It is an organization with which we contract. So the asset process, which is our human services process in the community for funding human services, they purchase some services from HERTA. Those are generally not ADA dial-a-ride services. The other group that purchases services from HERTA in the county area is SciRide. SciRide is a federal transit organization. They are responsible for providing paratransit. And that transit concept comes through the SciRide process.
Paratransit is?
ADA issued problematic transit. So getting people around who, due to disabilities, are not able to get around any other way.
Okay.
So SciRide receives federal funding, and they pass that federal funding through to the HERTA organization for the dial-a-ride. I'll call it the product. But that product is not identical in every way to the regular HERTA product. That product is just non-ADA required transit for anyone in the community who finds it the best way to get around. For instance, if I meet ADA requirements, I'm part of the dial-a-ride process, which HERTA provides. If I don't, but I find using SciRide or using taxi services is too challenging in terms of either logistics or dollars, then I might use the HERTA services, the regular services. We had users in both categories give feedback that they felt the services were inadequate or not to the level they desired or they anticipated that SciRide would prefer. SciRide's level of service is very, very high. We have a lot of people riding the bus. We have many buses. It's a very high level of transit service in this community. The dial-a-ride service that we contract with, we were getting feedback, wasn't meeting those same expectations. And so SciRide, and I'd like to thank SciRide and Sherry Kyris and the board, they actually kind of utilized their role in the dial-a-ride process. They utilized that role to create a conversation about overall quality of service. And that's how we began to discuss these issues with regards to HERTA.
And what sorts of issues with service delivery, or the product, as you say, was HRTA having?
We had this issue from a resident, a user. We also have had feedback from other organizations in the community, human service organizations that depend on HRTA, not just Dial-A-Ride. They depend on the HRTA services in general to get their users, people like LSI, Mainstream Living.
What's
Heartland,
LSI?
Lutheran Services.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then Heartland Senior Services. All of these organizations have a user group that utilizes the HRTA services, that needs transportation, that Cyride can't meet the level necessary, either by their ability to physically get to it or to get themselves from bus to bus to bus. Those all create challenges. So we had feedback from these organizations that they were having a hard time utilizing the service. And this really came to a large impasse when there was one organization that was told they couldn't add any more services because they lacked drivers. There was not the capacity to move their users. And because the asset process provides money for HRTA for the very reason of moving these people around the community, we had to ask ourselves a harder question. If we can't move some of these people around the community, we need to talk about what we're trying to achieve, and maybe we need to rearrange some items and ask HRTA, what can we do to help you do your job in a broader way to meet the expectations that we were hopefully having, which is to get people around the community who need to get around.
Yeah, I can imagine people missing appointments, medical appointments, getting medication that they need to stay, you know, happy
and alive.
Yeah, it could be that could be a real difficulty. Now, but you mentioned that the okay, let's go back to basics
a
little bit. First of all, you've mentioned that there's a federal category for disability, and then there's also the user who might just have an off the route, off the Cyride route ride that that person needs and calls up HRTA and says, "I need a ride."
Mm-hmm.
How much do they pay for a ride?
I want to say $5, but I'm not sure.
Okay, and then does the ride go out of county or out of – can it go outside of the limits of Ames? For instance, many people need to go from Ames to Nevada to visit the courthouse and the county seat. Some people have appointments in Boone. Do Ames residents get HRTA rides that are outside the limit of Ames?
The service is currently contracted through ASSET, which is Story County, GSB, the City of Ames, and United Way. So that does go beyond the Ames borders. Now, HRTA itself, again, the third party, they contract with other counties as well.
Uh-huh.
And just to be very clear, I am in no way an expert on the logistics of HRTA. I am at the policy level sort of talking about quality in general. And one of the things we as policymakers try to do is not get too down into the nitty-gritty of the process. But when we get feedback from the community, which is kind of the question you asked earlier, we got this feedback. Transit Board, the Cyride Board, took a lead and said, hey, let's get together. And this is very complex, right? It's not that HRTA is doing a terrible job. Their expectations are high. We have a lot of people to move around the community. Right now, Cyride has a challenge getting drivers, just like HRTA has a challenge getting drivers. And that has led to problems for both groups.
Why do you think it's so hard to get drivers?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on labor. All I know is all I know is that we have multiple organizations who have basically the same activities so that their employees produce the same outcomes. Both of them are having problems recruiting new drivers.
Okay.
Now, and Cyride does have, a pretty strong relationship with the student body, so that might make it a little easier for them to recruit for those jobs. But and HRTA is probably a little further away from that large pool of people who could take on some part-time work. But that's conjecture. I haven't done any studies, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, that might be. I mean, these are part-time jobs. They're not full-time jobs.
I think both exist.
Uh-huh.
But I think the student population, Cyride has kind of revolved around that population. So I think they feed in a lot of part-time work.
Sure.
But there's also full-time drivers. And so I think what the goal here really has been to try to figure out how we can partner with them and maybe expand the providers. You know, one of the things you saw is RSVP is in here, and I'm not very familiar with RSVP. But taxis is in this document too, that there are many groups providing transportation services. Even some of our assisted living facilities have their own transportation.
Yeah.
And I think that this conversation was to take a step back and be as broad as possible and see what might be out there and not just limit ourselves to a conversation only on HRDA.
Okay. So why don't you kind of summarize what the solutions that you're proposing are? And
I think one thing to understand is Council never has really had a chance to weigh in on this document. This conversation was occurred with Sherry Curtis in the room.
Sherry Curtis of CyRite,
the director.
Okay.
And then Deb Schildroth from Story County, and then HRDA representation, and then some users, and I'm not sure of the whole list of users, but Mainstream Living was involved and some other users. And maybe I should be more accurate. They're not users, but their clients are users,
yes.
Which is another challenge here. Not all of the clients who use this service have all of the skills that might make quality assessment simple.
Sure.
Some of them are challenged, verbally, mentally, or otherwise. And so that can create complications when you're trying to cull information from your user, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, the things that are in the document that is presented tonight and that'll be taking community feedback, council hasn't – we've seen it, but we haven't talked about it. And so it's more of a recommendation from this ad hoc group, which was some representatives of users, or at least representatives of users, and then also the CyRite and HRDA representation in city and county. They had different categories, and you can look at the document. You can find it on the city website, but it's, community partnerships. And a lot of these aren't solutions as much as we need to get to a point where we talk about solutions. So the community partnerships, there's multiple items. Explore effective short and long-term solutions to resources. So thinking about ISU, taxis, assisted living, and an agency organization vehicles. So that's the capacity we talked about, right? That's in the community partnership concept. There's another category of infrastructure improvements that's communicate HRDA's plan to update buses and make sure they have quality buses to provide the service so the bus shows up when you need it. Other concepts are the internal modifications for HRDA. How's HRDA working with feedback right now? When I call and say, hey, my ride didn't come, or I'm working at Mainstream Living and one of my clients might have not been picked up, how are they integrating that information and how are they creating changes with that input? So modifications internally for HRDA, which is kind of unique that this group is creating some internal modifications for a third party. But as partners, that's kind of the very impressive part of this process, that there was a forum to have that conversation rather than just that's what we do and this is what HRDA does. We kind of came together and looked at each other and what we could all do together. Having a transportation collaboration committee, which now exists, agree to discuss and solve issues at the grassroots level. And this was a little bit about
– That would – yeah. Yeah. I wonder that, rideshare programs have been so popular around the country. I'm wondering whether some of the infrastructure you build is some kind of communication network where people can post, I need this ride. And somebody who is, community minded might go to that place and say, oh, this person needs a ride. That's convenient for me to take care of.
I think any solution is a solution, right? And I think that they're kind of starting at the base level where those kind of solutions are not out of the list yet. Sometimes when you're trying to solve problems, there's a lot of things that people are unwilling to change. But I feel there's a lot of openness in both the HRDA side and also the user side and the organizational side in terms of mainstream or LSI that mm-hmm. flexibility is important. I think rideshare could very well be a piece. And these would be great things for people to come and share at the feedback session tonight.
Because and what's the time of that meeting?
It is 6:30 to 8:30 tonight.
Okay, 6:30 to
8:30. Oh, thank
you. I looked it up myself.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you, Matthew, for coming into the studio to explain this issue to our listeners.
Well, Matthew, we have a little time here. So perhaps you'd like to tell us what's your wish list for the future for the city council?
Sure. I think it'll be an exciting year. We're going to do a lot of work on the land use policy plan, hopefully looking at that document again and trying to make sure that it's still current and allowing and encouraging the kind of development that's good for the community over the long haul. Two of the things that I'm very excited about working on this year. One is the SciRide funding model. I think we've had some challenges with regards to SciRide growth. FareFree, in the context of the students, the GSB funds FareFree SciRide, has really grown SciRide. It's up over 6 million riders this year. And for a community our size, that's quite high. And that has really put a lot of pressure on the organization in terms of funding. That in conjunction with a trend in decreased federal funding has created challenges. Right now, a student ride costs a little over 70 cents, whereas a resident ride costs maybe closer to a dollar. Mm-hmm. And those user groups are very different. Generally, the residents who are using SciRide are low to moderate income. They have few technologies like smartphones to take advantage of the Next Bus scheduling system that's a very fancy and high-end product the students use quite a bit. And I think at some point, SciRide, which is made up of the GSB, the university, and the City of Ames, should look at trying to bring those costs at least closer together such that the citizens of the community who probably need that service the most aren't paying more than the student body in the community and try to keep that a little more even. So that's an improvement I'd like to really work on this year. Another one is the idea of taking a more aggressive look at the results of our human services funding, especially for me personally in the context of youth. They're historically communities with good, comfortable communities like the City of Ames. We're a great community. We're pretty lucky. And we generally kind of shy away from the harder questions. And one of those questions that are being asked more and more nowadays are not just are you funding your human services, but how likely are your human services to create the outcomes you desire in them? And there are a lot of communities and there's a lot of research right now. One of the techniques to do that out of the research is called youth master planning. The idea here is that you, instead of taking groups who want to provide services to youth, you create a plan first that says, what do we need to provide the youth of this community to create responsible, capable adults? And those categories that have come out of best practices are oftentimes, family education, preschool information, out-of-school time activities, and nutrition. If your kids aren't eating, they're less likely to be successful in school. They're less likely to be motivated to take in the information they need that they'll some time in the future leverage to create an adult life for themselves. And what we've done heretofore in the community is we have a great process called the asset process, which is an amazing way to collaboratively fund services. We have the GSB involved, Story County, the City of Ames, and United Way are all major contributors to this large fund to fund services in Story County. But as far as making sure that every service we provide is creating the outcomes we desire, we are quite a ways behind on that concept because, to be honest, it's quite a new concept. It hasn't been happening for a long time. And this sort of test-based rubric with which to look at your services will really help any organization make sure that every dollar they spend is going to yield the results they hope to. And this could be – the argument could be made for this in every category. We have senior services. You could ask the same question. Are the senior services producing the outcomes that are desired? But my greatest concern is with youth. Over the past 50 years in the United States, we have seen the wages of the single adult male basically stagnate, whereas other wages, especially in terms of the context of corporate America, executive pay have skyrocketed.
Right.
The GDP has grown much larger than the rate of the single adult male. What that story says to me is that we are not creating enough opportunities for every person to get ahead.
Right.
And so the reason this idea of youth master planning and guaranteeing that the money we spend on youth is creating positive outcomes is part of creating economic mobility, which is the basis of a fair society.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have economic mobility in your community, in your city, your county, your state, or your nation, you're failing the individuals that you were just lucky enough not to be. And so for me, that is a passion of mine, and I'm hoping that the council will commit to doing something about it. And the council can't do it alone. It needs the school district to be involved. It needs Mary Greeley Medical Center to be involved. It needs United Way. It needs the police. It needs a lot of different partners. Healthcare is a big piece of future success of kids, and making sure that we have a plan that takes in all the elements of success, and then we start thinking about our resources and how they are helping with that plan, I think is a much better long-term way of creating positive results. And we've just never had that conversation in the same way.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Matthew Goodman, Ames City Council member, also on the board of directors of CyRide, talking about tonight's meeting in City Council chambers on the topic of HRTA services and transportation in general. Anyone in Ames who has had trouble getting the transportation they need is encouraged to speak at this meeting.
Bearing in mind the storm we're going to have, maybe. And that's all we have for Local Talk today. We've been your hosts, Kay Puttock and Greta Anderson. Earlier we heard about the Squaw Creek Watershed Coalition from Irv Klaus, and a little about the art music collaboration, Rebirth, which is continuing for the next 2 weeks in Ames. Weekends in Ames.
Links to all the relevant information will be posted on our website, khoyfm.org, by the end of the day. That's khoyfm.org. You can also listen to this show or any part of our past Local Talk shows by going to the Local Talk page.
Music you heard and can hear now is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. And also Embryonic Journey by Jefferson Airplane.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. Get involved by contacting us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or by coming by the studio at 410 Douglas Avenue across from the Octagon and filling out a volunteer form.
As always, your participation as a listener is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio. She'd show me what she bought.